well, brilliant, profound, and terrific. And listen to a proposition I have. What do you say of this?
Who are you?
Howard Forsyth.
Oh.
Alberta's three universities do something in line with what the speaker was talking about, really. Alberta, say, takes Islam and says, we'll put in an Islam college if Dafar will put in another one, and we reciprocate in order to be defensive about one of the greatest clashes. China, because we're going the other way, offensive, put in one at Calgary for College of Chinese Studies, Hong Kong for College of Canadian Studies. Bill Clayton and I have talked about this. Lethbridge, one for displacing Latin America and Caribbean. The U.S. has muffed the Monroe Doctrine for 200 years. Three universities in in Alberta will be worldwide, and it would fit, wouldn't it? You like that?
Well, not only like that, but we've got started on it. When I was Minister of Advanced Education, one of the things that I think is, and I hope I'm not sounding immodest, and there's one of the most brilliant things we were able to do was the Access to the Future Fund, which sets up an endowment fund which has two purposes. One is to match donations and contributions from the private sector and the community into the post-secondary realm. But the other one is to fund new and novel ways to create and transfer knowledge. Two things that we committed to out of that fund, one is relevant to this. When we did the throne speech last year, we indicated that we would be matching the MacTaggart gift to the University of Alberta. The MacTaggart family gave $37 million worth of Chinese art and artifacts to the University of Alberta to begin the creation of an Institute for Chinese Studies. And we'll match that with $37 million from the Access to the Future Fund, which will create the best center of Chinese knowledge and Chinese studies in the West. And that's absolutely essential with the emerging Chinese market, the emerging Chinese economy, and the impact that China is going to have on the world, that we know and understand them. And if that knowledge center is based right here in Alberta, that really gives us a lift. So absolutely what you're talking about. The other part of what you're talking about, of course, is then going to get the matching side from China so that they participate. And the University of Alberta and the University of Calgary both have created relationships in China, but you're absolutely right, we should focus it. Islam studies again, and again, this is at the University of Alberta, but there's a group in the Ismaili Muslim community that have committed to raising funds to endow a chair, and again, it'll be matched from the Access to the Future Fund, to endow a chair in Islamic studies, and we need to take that further and create the Institute for Islamic Studies, because that's, as you quite rightly pointed out, one of the single biggest areas of conflict in the world today, and we need to know it and understand it and be able to share, again, some of the fact that, of Alberta and Canada, that we are a very cosmopolitan place and we live together better here than most places in the world, and we should be able to export some of that, I hate the word tolerance, some of that understanding and development. We need to do that. I think it makes sense to build on the work that's been done already at the University of Lethbridge in terms of North-South relationship, particularly with the Latin American world. We need to understand that as a sphere of influence, a sphere of influence for us. And again, as neighbors of the United States, they and we both have a very high degree of interest in finding a better relationship between us as opposed to collateral or bilateral relations between each of us and the United States. So that makes an awful lot of sense. That's the type of education, the impact on the future education, internationalization of education, which is really important to our knowledge and understanding of the world and the world's knowledge and understanding of us.
My name is Andy Davies. I'm a university student here. My question is about income contingent loan repayment regarding the loan repayment that students make. I'm sure you're familiar with it. If you'll grant me just a second to familiarize some in the crowd. What this is a loan repayment scheme where when you finish your post-secondary education, you repay, your payments are made based on your income. So if you're a lower income earner post-secondary, then you pay a lesser amount, but consequently you pay over a longer time. This is already something that's been tried in Australia, and what has the results have been that people have paid far more due to the fact that it's staggered over a much longer time, have ended up paying far more for their education than prior to the implementation of income contingent loan repayment. And it especially affects, people that are better off are able to pay off very quickly and therefore don't suffer from interest as much. People that take longer, which is often the case, women, or at least it adversely affects women to a greater extent because they may take time off to raise children, or the reality is that they're still earning less than men for the same job anyways. One of the Canadian studies said that 43% of women would not be capable of paying off their post-secondary debt after 25 years because it drags out it increases the interest and drags it out. And it's interesting that you mentioned Milton Friedman before, because he actually is the original, as the world is flat comment, he's actually the original architect of this type of repayment scheme. It's set up as, or it's pitched as a...
Thomas Friedman, not Milton. Yeah, Milton
Friedman. Oh, you mentioned Thomas Friedman? Friedman? I'm sorry, I misheard you. Absolutely. Milton Friedman was the is the architect of this. My question is, as leader of the party and potentially the province, can I have from you an ironclad guarantee in front of witnesses and cameras that you will not pursue a income contingent loan repayment system that is obviously to the detriment of certain groups, and that you will rail against it if it's presented by others?
No, you can't have that guarantee. Because you can't guarantee anything in this life. We have had, over the course of the last year and a half, a discussion of Alberta as a learning society. We've had a lot of discussion about how we make Alberta a better place for learning. And part and parcel of that is making sure that post-secondary education is affordable. That's not just tuition. That's about all the costs of getting to school and going to school. But it's a package. And we have to find a way to take the risk factor out, because the risk is really one of the barriers to persons with middle income persons essentially getting an education. Low income tends to be funded well, or at least funded. High income doesn't worry too much about the risk. It's people like myself and others who are in my area of income, coming as the youngest of seven kids from a family that was essentially at the lower end of middle income, but was fortunate to have a mom who really valued education. And so we could take that risk, but so many don't. Some people point to Ireland and say, well, they took the tuition fee out, and that made a huge difference. And it did. It didn't increase the participation rate. It did for a short time, but it came back down. But it flattened the demographics. It made it more available to more people. And that's what we have to try and aspire to, is to make sure that everybody knows that they can afford to go. Now, my personal preference would be that we put together a package which compiles grants and loans, so that, for example, when Bridget and I were on the Student Finance Board, we had actually quite a good package there. We had maintenance assistance grants, student assistant grants, supplementary assistant grants, so that if somebody came and you could take a look at their profile and say, you'll never make it through under the loan limits, they would get a grant at the front end. Some of that has been institutionalized and some of that's been changed. But what we need to do is to build that system so that somebody coming in, first of all, knows that finances are not a barrier to a student getting an education. That there is a contribution to be made by a student and their family to getting an education. And education has a value, and it's the best investment you'll ever make, and you ought to make part of that investment. But it has to be affordable, and it has to be affordable in a reasonable way. Now, my personal preference in terms of one of the solutions would be to say that everybody who stays in Alberta for 3 years after they graduate gets to deduct 10% of their defined cost of education as a refundable tax credit for each year for 10 years. And if you're 150 miles out of Edmonton and Calgary, maybe it's 20%, so that you do it faster. So that there's an encouragement to stay, to build, and to grow the Alberta economy. And if you move out of the province, then you can pay it back. But so I think there's a number of different ways to look at it. But I can't give you an ironclad guarantee that I will rail against income contingent loan repayment. Sorry.
Thanks ever so much. And my name is John Boris. I'm going to keep my question very narrow as compared to what I quite often do. I just go right across the whole spectrum. But I want to bring talk about or discuss the same point that you're discussing right now. I'm a veteran. I would never have accomplished getting a BSc in agricultural economics and a law degree 10 years later had I not been a veteran. Because I was a veteran, I got my tuition paid the first time. I got whatever I had to, where I slept, that was paid for. And if you ask people in Sweden and Norway, at least I'm told, that this is nothing but gold-plated returns to those people that go to school. And look around you, and I remember being in the University of Alberta for my first degree, and those were people that are active. They're still, at my age, a lot of them were, they're still involved in community and types of boards. And I don't think you could lose if you put in something like that. There's no cost at all to the first degree, I think, is the what is in Sweden. Why can't we use oil to more finance more of this for students? It'll come back in taxes.
Well, I certainly agree with the concept that we get a value back. Both the individual and society gets a huge payment back from pursuing education. And so that we have there's a value to society investing in that, investing in individuals getting their education, pursuing their education. And so I fundamentally believe in the concept that finances cannot be a barrier. The question is, how do we put it together? And we talked about it. In fact, during our process last year of talking about Alberta as a learning society, I tossed out, just for the sake of getting the discussion robust, some ideas that had come forward. One of them was to pay the first 2 years of tuition. And that actually got quite a lot of discussion going. The cost to 2 years of tuition is about $500 million. And that's probably not a bad investment. But if you take a look at the resources that we have available and how we can invest those resources, our first priority has got to be making more places available for more students and making sure that every student has the opportunity to go. And there's not an unlimited amount of resources, even with all the oil revenues. First of all, they don't belong just to us. They belong to future Albertans, and so we have an obligation to, in my view, to protect the capital and invest only the earnings from it. But if we had $500 million to put into education, and I hope we do, then what we need to do is expand the number of places and spaces for students to go and the opportunities to learn. We also need to make sure that finances are not a barrier to any single student going. And that's coming from someone who, I grew up in northern Alberta in a little town called Fort Vermilion and graduated from Lacrete School. There were six of us who graduated that year. It was the first class out of the Lacrete High School, or Lacrete Public School. And I came to university and my first class was about 400 students. And I had to finance that education. And it was the best investment I ever made. And I paid it back over 10 years at interest rates that I had to consolidate at 15%. And I could have done a lot more with my money if I hadn't had to do that. But it was the best investment I ever made. And so I'm loath to say it should be free. We can look around the world and see where education has been free and some of the good things that have happened. But for my money, if I had $500 million or $1 billion, I think we should create the longest, strongest, most the best system of universities, colleges, and technical schools you could possibly have, pursue the edge of knowledge, be among the best 20 in the world, and make sure that no student who's capable of going to any place in the system is turned back because of finances. And I think we can do that without making it free.
Hi there. My name is Jamie Huckabee. I'm a student at the U of L. And my question would be in relation to a lot of the trust funds that the Alberta government is managing. I read a report that said the return on investment was somewhere in the vicinity of 5%, which is quite poor compared to what a lot of hedge funds and things are making. Would you suggest any changes to how the government is managing the capital that we're receiving from the resources, or would you suggest that you know, we ship that money into the private sector more, or change the way we're managing it. I'm not totally familiar with how it's worked, but do you have any ideas in that area?
A couple of things that allows me to talk about. First of all, we should probably broaden the investment scope of those funds. Right now, they're managed. We hire a professional investment manager, pay them good money to manage our portfolios. We could actually take some of the portfolios, put them out into the private sector on a competitive basis, and look for better returns. But we have to be careful about that, because this is an endowment portfolio. This is a heritage fund, and so you have to be careful about, like, investing in hedge funds and running up on the dot-coms and those sorts of things. Those probably wouldn't fit most of your a portfolio of that nature. But the other thing we ought to do is to take a look at the investments we have, because one of the things we don't have in this province to the extent we need it is the financial market for the technology community. We don't have the investment money. There's not a shortage of money in this province, but the traditional economy is too good, and it's hard to retrain that capital into a new economy without some way of incenting it. And if we took 3 to 5% of the Heritage Fund, just as an example, and we put that into the market in tranches of $25 or $50 million, and we said to the market, you bring your $25 or $50 million to match that, and then invest the total pool and show us that you've brought the investment acumen to live in this province and that you're going to grow the investment knowledge in that area, that would be a huge boon to our technology and our emerging industries. And that's something we ought to do with those funds. So there's two things. One, you talked about the investment return. Theoretically, our Heritage Trust Fund is an investment return fund now, and it's not getting the returns that it ought to get. So we need to find strategies to do that. And one of those strategies would be to bring in some element of private investment. I know my own portfolio, when you're in cabinet, you have to put your assets into a blind trust. My own portfolio is operating much better and on a very conservative investment strategy than the Heritage Savings Trust Fund is. And so there's an ability to bring some of that expertise in. But we also ought to be looking at those funds and saying, how can we use them in a broader perspective to build the future economy of the province? And we can do that without significantly increasing the risk. There may be an impact on some return, but if you're only talking about 3 to 5% of the portfolio, that wouldn't be significant, and it would make a huge difference to growing the investment acumen and the investment platform for the biotech, life sciences, and nanotech part of the community that we're trying to grow.
My name is Henry Heinen, and I want to know, if possible, how will the new prospective leader of the party and premier be elected? Before Klein was elected, we had every member had a vote, and we had two elections, as a matter of fact.
Well, you asked the right person. I grew up in the party. I was president of the Youth Association. I have served in the party and in virtually every volunteer capacity you can be in, including president of the party. And when I was president of the party, we brought in the one person, one vote process. And then when the last leadership process was run, I actually chaired the process. So I'm the only person who can claim to have invented the process, chaired the process, and now running in the process. I can't actually claim to have invented the process. I was only part of that. It's a one-person, one-vote process, so anybody who's prepared to buy a membership card and show up on a Saturday, likely in November, to vote can participate. And then there'll be a second. The way it works is that there will be a polling station in every constituency. Now, I have to put a caveat on this because the Rules Committee hasn't yet been struck and hasn't yet established the rules. But I have it on good authority because they hired the same returning officer that I got volunteer last time, Sonny Mirth, and he was instrumental in getting the rules together. I suspect they'll keep the same rules. So it'll be, and constitutionally it has to be a two-week system. So anybody can buy a membership. Anybody can participate in the process. The polling stations will be set up in each constituency across the province, so you have to show up. That's the commitment you have to make, is to show up on a Saturday to vote or in the advance poll. And then the top three candidates go to the second ballot. And the second ballot would be the following week or perhaps 2 weeks, and it would be a preferential ballot. So you'd mark your ballot 1, 2, 3. Now, last time, some of you may recall, there was just two people on the second ballot, but that's because Rick Orman, who was the third candidate, was significantly far behind and didn't think he He didn't feel it was valid to participate in that second week, so he dropped off voluntarily. But the way the system is designed, three candidates go to the second ballot. So we all have to be nice to each other through the process. I should say this as well. It doesn't involve any branding. So people can participate in the process because they want to participate in selecting the next premier of the province. And my hope is that many, many Albertans will want to do that. And then I will take my chances, once I'm elected as leader, that I can continue to keep you interested and involved in our party and our process, if you're not already.
Hi, I'm John Hill, the new LCCSA president. And I just have a couple quick points, and I'm actually going to get to my question. Just in regards to you completely, going back to the lovely Edmonton legislation minutes here from May 15th, the amendment was brought up for Bill 40 in order to keep it in, rather the act as opposed to changing it. And by your self-admittance, you said you did not like the bill itself, and you wish it wasn't in the House at the current time. And personally, you thought that you agreed that it would be better in the act, but you still encouraged other members of the Ledge to vote against the amendment that would keep it in the Post-Secondary Act. I'm not 100% if I'm getting this right. I've been going over it a couple hundred times in my head. But I'm curious as to why you voted against it later on when it went to vote. And I know now with the Standing Committee for Bill 40, the Standing Committee, with Actus Act Cause and your opposition all being on the Standing Committee, when can we expect to see the first meeting of the Standing Committee? And is there any guarantees right now that we would, in fact, have our input into these standing committees taken into account? Not to second-guess government by any stretch of the imagination, but sometimes, it may have just come across as lip service in some sense, and I just want to know, as leader of the party, or hopefully as leader of the party, what kind of commitments we can see as both members of ActiSec and the students of what we can see from that. Thank you.
Well, I like that hopefully as leader of the party part. I'm detecting some sense of warmth here. First of all, in speaking to Bill 40, I was a member of government. I was advanced education minister up until, I believe it was April the 3rd when I resigned. I was also government house leader. When you're a member of cabinet, and particularly when you're government house leader, your job, whether you win or lose the discussion in caucus, your job is to take that to the floor of the House and make sure it gets enacted. Now, I'm liberated now. I stepped out because I need to have more freedom to talk about the future and where we're going in the future. And that's why I gave up a job which I loved. I was passionate about advanced education. I loved being advanced education minister. But if you want to talk about the future of the province in the long term, I couldn't do that job at the same time. So I had to leave it. So that freed me up to be able to speak in the House as I did more freely about the fact that I believed that we didn't need Bill 40. Right, and I'll tell you why we did. In my view, we didn't need Bill 40. Now, the department disagreed with that, and obviously the new minister disagreed with that, and caucus agreed with the new minister and agreed that we needed to bring it forward. And in the end result, it won't matter. But I didn't agree with Bill 40 because it created a controversy where we didn't need to have one. I'm sure Bill will agree with me, and maybe he won't. He can tell you if he doesn't, that if I, as Minister of Education, Advanced Education, came to him and said, we're bringing in a new policy this fall, on tuition, and we'd like you to advise your board of that when you're making your decisions with respect to your budget, and take it into account, because it's likely going to be in legislation anyway, and you don't really want to have to adjust when we legislate it. Right? So the people who were concerned about the fact that there may not be a fall session and we wouldn't be able to amend the Post-Secondary Learning Act to put in the new tuition policy, said, well, the option is to put a tuition policy in regulation, and that's what Bill 40 was. But you could have avoided that just by saying, ignore it. That any tuition increases next year aren't going to be bigger than what was in the Act. And I understand, if we talk to the colleges and the universities and the technical institutes and let them know where we're going, they likely will comply, because they don't want to have to comply retroactively when the Act is changed later, if for no other reason. Likely they'll comply because we have a very collaborative working relationship. So that's why I said it wasn't necessary and I didn't like it. I think it created an unnecessary agitation for no good reason, in my view. I stayed out of the House when the bill was voted on for the same reason.
During the second reading, you just have you were against the motion that would stop that, and you were saying how.
Well, it's against the amendment because the amendment would have changed a government bill, and I'm obliged to support the government bill at that stage. Right? But I stayed out of the House when we voted on it. But it's a bit of a tempest in a teapot. Dennis, I've got all faith in the world in Dennis Herard as the minister who's committed to talking about the tuition policy, to having the committee work on the tuition policy and putting that tuition policy into the regulations. And yes, I think it would be appropriate in the future to put the tuition policy in the Act. The reason it's not in the Act now, the reason for Bill 40 was this interregnum, because he had no confidence that we would have a session this fall to do it, and the policy has to be in place for next year. Was there a second question I missed?
Just what kind of guarantees can we see with the Standing Policy Committee and
Yeah, well, Dennis is committed to doing that. I can't give you guarantees because I'm no longer the minister. But that's the framework we set up. We set up a very collaborative process. I'm sure you would agree that that throughout that process we've kept our commitment to consult and involve every sector of the education system, students included. And I don't see any reason why that won't continue. And Dennis has made that commitment publicly. He's made it in the House. I think he's made it in writing by letters to student groups in the opposition. So it would be pretty hard for him not to keep that commitment.
We have three more questioners. I hope we can get through them all, and then I know you have to leave, Mr. Hancock. Please, go ahead.
Paul Hinman, just a quick question that you didn't talk too much about, but it's always about the future and protecting Alberta, especially within our great confederation. But how do you feel about having an Alberta pension plan, looking after an Alberta police force, as well as enshrining property rights here in the province?
Another person who has confidence in me winning the leadership so he can start question period right away. Look, if we're going to go to an Alberta pension plan, we should do it for valid economic reasons, not for firewall reasons. It's not about, you don't go to a pension plan to segregate Alberta from the rest of the country. There may be a reason at some time to go to an Alberta pension plan because we want an investment pool of money. Right now, I think it would be a question as to whether that would be an appropriate economic move, particularly given that we have investment pools that we could utilize, so we don't have to create a new one right now. In terms of provincial police force, again, you don't go to a provincial police force for firewall reasons. You don't go to a provincial police force to segregate us from the rest of the country. We've got a long and good history with the RCMP as our provincial police force. Those that argue that we need to have a provincial police force so we can have political control forget the fact that you don't have political control of a police force. You shouldn't have political control of a police force. And so it's a wrong argument to go to a provincial police force. If it makes more sense economically to have our own police force because we get better value for our investment dollar, then you should consider it, but not to segregate Alberta from the rest of the country. And your third one was? Oh, property rights. We have property rights. In fact, as individuals in this province, in this country, we're born with rights. We give some of those rights up voluntarily to the state where necessary. We have a charter of rights that came in. But let no one delude you into believing that that actually gave us rights. It actually just put a definition around those rights. We have property rights now. If somebody wants to take away property that you own for some public reason, they have to account for it. They have to go through an appropriate process. So, people argue about whether property rights should be enshrined in the Constitution. To be honest, the less you put into a constitution and the less you put into law, the better off we are. Every single law we create takes away from your rights, doesn't create them.
Okay. Hi, my name is Ron Liu and I'm from the University of Lethbridge. I just actually had a quick question. Well, I don't know if it'll be quick, but just regarding if elected leader, what you would do about the current health care. You know, health care is something that Canadians pride ourselves on, and I was wondering what your thoughts were on, especially now with all this talk about privatization.
I love it. Just a quick question, she says. I can't answer that question in complete detail in the time we have. Let me just tell you this. Any discussion of healthcare has to start from the premise. Okay.
Any discussion of healthcare has to start from the premise that we have a publicly funded system where Albertans have access to quality care on a timely basis without regard to ability to pay. That's fundamental. That was fundamental of our discussion all the way along. Then the question, though, is how do you make sure that that system is sustainable, is there for Albertans, and if it's appropriate, how and when do you provide other choices? The real impact for us is not continuing to play with the acute care system. The real impact for us is how we encourage Albertans to be healthy. And how do we invest money in making sure that we prevent disease rather than cure it? So we've got to focus on wellness. We've got to tell people like myself. I joke sometimes. I lost 60 pounds. People asked me about that. And I said, well, I had a very significant health scare in the fall of 2004. I thought I might be health minister. But my point is this, that a man of 50 years of age who is 100 pounds overweight is at significant risk for diabetes, significant risk for stroke. Every male over 50 ought to be concerned about being a significant risk for prostate cancer. And we have to do something about it ourselves. So that the health system that we move to, and there's lots of good things that have happened in the health system, but the things we need to build on is how do we prevent disease, how do we encourage and incent Albertans to take care of themselves, recognizing that things happen to people. You can't develop a system which punishes people for getting sick, but we can develop a system which helps people pay more attention to their health, and we can invest in research and development, and then we can worry about choice, because some people can go to Birmingham to get a hip, and if they can, why can't they do it here? But not until you've established what the benchmarks are in the public system, what people can expect to get in the public system, and the fact that every person has access to quality care on a timely basis without regard to ability to pay.
Thank you. Let's have this last question. I know Steve's waiting there. He'll be flying low to the airport.
Thank you. My name is Charlotte Kingston, and I'm also a representative from the University of Lethbridge Student Union. And I just have two questions for you. One of them, I swear, though, is very quick. It's regarding the new Rural Student Grant Fund that's been administered as the result of a Learning Alberta. We've noticed that it's attached to the Millennium Scholarship Fund, and we were just wondering whether these grants will run out in 2009 and suffer the same fate as the Millennium Scholarship Fund. And if so, and also, how do you plan to compensate for the loss of the Millennium Scholarship Fund to students in 2009? That's my first question. And my second one, sir, is that in a conversation with the new Advanced Ed Minister, Mr. Denis Herald, we were talking about the goal of having post-secondary education funded in great part by employers. And I was wondering what your views on this proposal are and how you would aim to sustain arts and non-profitable research in this climate where employability would become the ultimate goal of education. It was about the Rural Student Grant.
Oh, yeah. We started this year. We had the opportunity to start. We were looking at rural incentive bursaries and working with Northern Alberta Development Council, et cetera, with respect to rural bursaries. And we had an opportunity. The Millennium Foundation came to us and said that they had some extra resources. And they came to Alberta because Alberta has taken them up better than any other jurisdiction in terms of their offer. And so we designed this new grant program because they had resources and we could match some of those resources and we could actually lever it into a larger amount of money for more students over the short term. But yes, the Millennium one does...